too much eating, too much drinking, things like that. So I hope that no one is suffering from some disturbance as a result of holiday celebrations. Now, celebration, to celebrate, is a natural part of human life. And as can be seen from this holiday season, people, they take advantage whenever there's opportunity to come together, to have parties, to have feasts. But as I was indicating, in modern culture, materialistic culture, goes overboard. People suffer as a result. But actually, the spirit to celebrate is originally transcendental. As you, I think all of you know, if you're regular attendees here, you know that in the spiritual world, in Krishna Loka, there is a constant celebration. This is how the spiritual world is described to us in the Vedic scriptures, that there is a constant celebration of love of God. So we, in this present situation in the material world, in this International Society for Krishna Consciousness, we are simply hoping to engage everyone more and more in the celebration of love of God, which has been made possible for us all by God Himself, by Krishna Himself, in His form as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared 500 years ago in India, and he started this process of celebrating love of God in the form of the Sankirtan movement. So this word Sankirtan, Kirtan means to glorify. The root is Kirti. Kirti is fame. So fame or glory is one of the opulences of God. He is all famous. He is all glorious. And everything that we are attracted to in this world, which is famous, is just a reflection or an aspect of God's original fame and glory. So to glorify Krishna is called kirtan. God is all famous, and if we come together and hear and chant the reasons why he's famous, because he is so beautiful and so powerful and so loving, all of his good qualities, then that is called kirtan, and that is a celebration. When we come together, sang means to come together, sankirtan, and we sing and we dance the glories of the Lord, that is a celebration. And thus celebrating, we experience the ecstasy of love of God. So this is actually a matter of direct experience. Everyone can share in that. This is what I'm saying is actually not esoteric. The word esoteric means something that's hidden, and you have to delve deeply to find it. But this is not esoteric. It's obvious. But you have to do it. So this is our invitation. This is why we hold such a festival. This is a festival, Sunday feast or festival. And this is why we hold such festivals, so that people can have the opportunity to come together and sing Krishna's holy name, chant, dance, hear about Krishna, and then take Krishna prasadam. This is delicious foodstuffs that have been offered to Krishna. So what does this do, this sankirtan process? It engages our senses and mind in Krishna in a most pleasing and tasteful way. It's enjoyable. Nobody can object to such simple activities, simple and delightful activities. So when the senses become engaged in Krishna through sankirtan, then the consciousness is purified. Our whole problem is impure consciousness. And I was starting off giving the example of celebration, that it is our nature to celebrate something. But the problem is in this material world, which is very dark, very full of ignorance, when we try to express this natural propensity to celebrate, generally we get ourselves in trouble. And that everyone has experience of. All material activities are full of problems. Why? Ultimately because they're based on the body. And this body is a place of problems. So we are identifying with this body due to impurity in our consciousness. So Krishna consciousness, this process, sankirtan, celebration of love of Godhead, this purifies the consciousness. This brings us back to our original position as spiritual beings. We're acting on the spiritual platform. And that activity, again, it is not morose, it is not sad. This is unfortunately the typical image that many people have of what is considered to be spiritual life. It is people who are unhappy, or who are afraid, or somehow or other they're perturbed and disturbed and very sad and sober mood. They're coming together to pray or something like that. But no, actually spiritual life, real spiritual life, is joyful. It is full of life and light. And this is the natural situation of the soul. An eternal celebration. And a celebration that does not end with a hangover, with an upset tummy, with regrets, with vows, I'll never do this again. As people experience when they try to celebrate in material society. So, this is what everyone wants. Everyone is looking for that. For love and for happiness and celebration. So, it is all within our grasp. As I said, it's not esoteric. It's all within our capacity. But the thing to do is to make Krishna the center. And this is the culture of Vaishnavism. You may know this word, Vaishnavism. It is the Vaishnavas, a religious community in India, whose object of devotion is Lord Vishnu or Krishna. So, Vaishnavism is a religious process of celebration, celebrating love of Godhead. So this is our invitation here. I'm very happy to see that you have come. I hear that this is, Markandeya tells me that this weekend of all weekends in the year is the one in which the least persons come here because everyone is recovering from their own celebrations at home. But I see that quite a number of you have come, and so I'm happy for that. So are there any questions? Yes?
Well, what does the term esoteric actually mean? Like, because so many people are involved today, they think they're involved in spiritual life, but actually, mm-hmm. maybe they are involved in, well, they talk about devas and subtle beings and all these things. What is actually that?
Yes. Well, the word esoteric, and then there's an opposite word, exoteric. So eso means hidden or inside. Esoteric means that which is, or you could say an equivalent word, is occult. So occult is something that's mysterious. You can see some effect, but you don't really know what the cause of it is. That's esoteric. And exoteric means something that is quite open, quite visible. Everyone can immediately understand and appreciate it. So Srila Prabhupada explained that the reason people are interested in the esoteric or the occult, or another word, the abstract, that which is beyond our perception, is because here in our present realm of knowledge and perception, we're not happy. We are trying to attain happiness, but we find that, or many people find, that through the, you know, the ordinary exoteric methods, that one doesn't become happy. And so, naturally, then one, because we want to be happy, and why do we want to be happy? So it's the same reason I was talking before, that this is natural to the soul. It is natural to us as souls to celebrate, to have desire, to want to love, to want happiness. This is all natural to us. And so we persist, even if there's frustrations, we persist in trying to find happiness, because that is our own nature. The soul is said to have three aspects: sat, chit, ananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss. And this is why we're always seeking these things, because now our eternity, our knowledge, our bliss is covered. It is covered up by matter. Simply because we think that we're the body. We've lost contact with ourselves as the soul. And so we think I'm the body, and then we think to be eternal, that's a big deal, you know, that's really something. Because we think I have to die. So to actually come to the eternal platform, wow, that must be far out. But actually we are eternal. We are right now. Nothing has to be added. We are eternal. But the problem is we identify with the body. And the same with knowledge. Krishna in Bhagavad Gita calls the soul jnani. Jnani means the knower. We are the knower. We do have transcendental knowledge right now, but it is covered. And similarly, bliss, same thing. Our bliss, our happiness is already there, but it's covered. Our state, Prabhupada said, is like that of an amnesiac, one who is, he is who he is, everything is there, his identity is there. Let's say he comes from a wealthy family, so all his, you know, security, loving relatives, they're all there. But what's the problem? He forgot it. He got amnesia somehow, got a knock on the head or whatever. And he forgot everything. And now he's wandering around on the street wondering, who am I? But his identity is there. The identity is not lost. His life is there, but he's forgotten it. And so that's our position. So anyway, yes, we want happiness. And we find in the realm of the senses, at least those who are, you know, a bit more sensitive, they will find that in the realm of the senses, that there actually is no happiness. There is some temporary pleasure, you know, the tingling of the senses when they contact their sense objects, there's some pleasure there, but it doesn't last. So happiness is something that lasts, and that's what we want. So when a person discovers that there's no real happiness on the sensual platform, then he wants to go beyond. So the sensual platform is exoteric, it's obvious. It's that platform which are revealed by our senses. So esoteric is beyond the senses. Another term, synonym for esoteric is metaphysical. And this means in the Greek language, beyond the physics. Physics means, you know, matter. You see? That's physical. So metaphysics, that means that which is beyond the material world. So people who have become frustrated in finding happiness in the material world, then they become metaphysical. They start to look into the realms of the, yes, esoteric and the occult to find happiness there. But too often, they only go as far as the platform of mind. There's a platform of body, and then there's a platform of mind. Mind is a subtle material platform. The platform of concepts and thoughts and emotions. So just as the physical platform is not stable, you can't count on it, you can't depend on it because it's always changing. So similarly, the mental platform is also not stable. It's also always changing. So if we roam around on the mental platform looking for happiness, we will also become frustrated. We have to come to the spiritual platform. Now the spiritual platform, yes, for some, they consider it to be the most esoteric level. And it can be, yes, in some processes, mystic yoga, like that, it is extremely esoteric, very demanding. Because in the mystic yoga system, in order to reach the spiritual platform, then you have to more or less negate the sensual and mental platform. You have to stop functioning on those platforms altogether. Now this is very esoteric. If you can just try to imagine what it must be like to no longer function sensually or mentally. And that's why the yogis go into trance. That's why they retire in the Himalayas in some cave. They cut themselves off from the sensual world entirely. And they cut themselves off from society, from perceptions of. They're just in a cave, in a dark cave, where there's no sound, no taste, no smell, nothing going on there. And then by the practice of pranayama, breath control, you can say, disengage the mind. The mind is, it's like the body is a machine, the mind is another machine, but it's a subtle machine. So it's like pulling out the plug, you know. First you pull out the plug of the body, and it's just sitting there in an asana. And then by the process of pranayama, inducing trance, through breath control, then one pulls out the plug of the mind. And the mind just stops. There's nothing, no more thoughts. Just suspended. And then one can begin to perceive the light of the pure spirit, the pure self. So this is possible, yes. This is possible to do. But we wonder how many will actually do it. That's another question. So, therefore, as I mentioned, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is Krishna himself, who appeared to bless us with this Krishna conscious process, he made the method for reaching the spiritual state very easy. It is actually, as I said, exoteric. Anyone can do it very easily, and you don't have to pull out the plug of the body and the mind, and in fact that's not recommended at all. Rather, you use the body and the mind in Krishna's service. So Krishna is the supreme soul, the supreme spirit, and everything is connected to him, everything has its origin in him. So the method of Krishna consciousness is to simply see the connection of everything to Krishna, connection of our body, of our senses, of our mind. So instead of pulling out the plug, what you do is you plug in to Krishna. You see? Yeah, you take the plug out of the material energy, Maya, but you plug into Krishna. And we receive our power. Because our bodies and our minds are powered. By what? By desire. They're powered by desire. By kama. Kama means desire. And that is the seed, the root of our material existence. So, people who are materialistic are simply those people whose physical and mental activities are powered by material desire. So, yes, we want to pull the plug out from that source of power. But then not just, you know, fall over and be inactive. Rather, no, we want to then plug in to the source of spiritual power, Krishna. So this means we should cultivate spiritual desire. And that is the basis of what we call Krishna consciousness, acting on spiritual desire. So in Krishna consciousness, there is, you know, community, Sangha it is called. This is not a process of separating oneself from society, but it is a process of entering spiritual society. And within that community, there is activity. All kinds of, all the activities that are necessary for human life, including even celebrations, festivals, all of that. But it is all done for Krishna. So the body functions for Krishna, the mind thinks for Krishna. And in this way, there's a very nice example of placing the iron, the piece of metal in the fire, in the flame. The flame represents transcendence, Krishna consciousness. So you have a piece of metal, you see, here's, this is not exactly iron, but it is metal. So this is quite opposite from fire, obviously. This is hard and cold and heavy. Whereas fire is bright and hot and light. It's lighter than air. So we can't imagine two things more opposite than metal and fire. But if you take metal and you put it in the fire, what happens after a few minutes? The metal becomes red hot. It becomes just like fire. And you can use then this red hot metal just like fire. You can light, you can ignite other things with it. You can warm your hands on it. Yes, it is just like fire. So this is the process. The body and the mind are material. They're not spiritual. So then we can say they are opposite of the spiritual nature. But if you place the body and mind in spirit, in the spirit of Krishna consciousness, in the spirit of love of Krishna, then they become, as metal does, red hot, become spiritualized. And thus there's no disharmony, there's no contradiction between the functions of the body and mind and the pure activities of the soul. There's a total harmony. So this is the idea of Krishna consciousness. And it is fully exoteric. It is obvious. There's nothing hidden away in the back room. It's very upfront. So it is made so exoteric by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for the people of this world today. Yes, as you have said, many people today are interested in the esoteric. But unfortunately, they do not have the capacity to actually make progress, to actually realize something esoterically. Because the esoteric path, which is the path of yoga, demands that we rigidly control our mind and our senses. This is what yoga is all about. if one continues to act on the material platform, not for Krishna, but just on the material platform, in ordinary mundane affairs, then you see his energy is bled off in the material world, and he won't have enough energy to maintain consciousness in this esoteric transcendental realm. He won't have the energy to fix his mind there. His or her mind will be distracted, and that makes yoga impossible. So Srila Prabhupada, when he came to the West, he used to ridicule the yoga societies that he saw when he came to New York, for example. And he said, this is not yoga, this is bhoga. Bhoga is a Sanskrit word which means a sense gratification. So it's just, some club of people coming together to sit in postures for, a little while. And then afterwards, ordinary life goes on. In fact, such yoga societies, they just become meeting grounds also for further involvement in material activities. The boys and girls get together at the yoga club and make arrangements to meet each other later on. So Prabhupada said, this is not yoga, this is just bhoga, just another feature of material existence. So this is not really to criticize, because this is the state of people today. Modern man is not equipped, he's not equipped to practice yoga. It's just not there. So what to do? So should we just forget about it? It's hopeless, and so let's just all go home and watch TV. No, that is why Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come. He's given us a process, an exoteric process, which, although it is very simple and uncomplicated and not mysterious, it's still, Prabhupada used to compare it to an elevator. It's like getting in an elevator and it just whisks you up to the top floor. Whereas the other method, yoga, mystic yoga, is like taking the stairs. So if you want to go to the top of a huge building, one of these skyscrapers, like they have in Stockholm, 25, 30, 50 floors. So to take the stairs, that's quite a job. But if you just take the elevator, it's very simple. So this process, Prabhupada compared to the elevator. Just get on board and go. No problems. Anything else? Yes?
If you have a relation to a woman and you're very fond of her and you try to become a devotee, What happens with the relation?
Well,
I'm thinking about the feelings and emotions, and Say you love Krishna. And
yes.
How does it fit together?
Yes, well, the background of all of our relationships and our emotions, our loving feelings for one another, the background is actually Krishna. This is explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 7th canto by Prahlad Maharaj, that our nature to love begins with Krishna. And that is actually love. Because loving Krishna includes all living beings, because all living beings are part of him. But the problem is that we've forgotten Krishna. And yet, as I said, the desire for love is still there in the soul. But now it becomes manifested separately from Krishna. And then we try to love this person or that person. But we try to love on the basis of material qualities, you see. Why do we love a particular other person? Because that person has particular material qualities that appeal to us. You see, as you say, the attraction, you're speaking of the attraction between a man and a woman. So men and women are attracted to each other because of their material qualities, that, you know, he or she looks in a certain way and acts in a certain way, which appeals to my own nature, my own conditioned nature. You know, so people who come from rather, you say, upper class backgrounds, who have been educated and a bit cultured, then they try, you know, they try to establish loving relationships with like-minded people. They find that attractive. Whereas other people who have, you know, blue mohawk hairstyle, they try to find love among similar such people. So you see here the influence of material conditioning. And this is an illusion, because those conditions on our love change. They cannot last. We all change in our physical appearance and everything with time. And finally it all is gone. It all is swept away by time. So to base our love of other people on that is, you know, it's not very hopeful.
I didn't mean exactly like that. I meant if you can find, I call it God or Krishna, mm-hmm. in the relation also, is it possible to find, to have the woman there?
Yes.
And have Krishna?
Yes, so that was just the point I was about to make. Okay. But the background, you see, the background of the material world is Krishna. The material world has come from Krishna. And so we are in this material world. I was just speaking of the, you know, the futility of trying to, you know, love another person on a material basis. We all want, when we speak of love, we think of love as something that lasts. You know, all the songs on the radio about love, they're all, you know, you hear these singers, they're making vows, I will love you forever, like that. That's what love means. Everybody knows that. But if you base your love on material conditions, then it is not really love, because it won't last. So we have to base our love on Krishna. So when we see Krishna, because Krishna is within the heart of every person, and we see Krishna as the actual source of attraction in our relationship with this person, that person, any person, then the love becomes illuminated with spiritual knowledge. You see, the problem with the material relationships is that we try to lay claim. This love, so-called love, is just a kind of egoism. You know, we're selecting this. I will love you because I like you. You're according to my material tastes, and I will possess you. This is the conception. So this is wrong. Rather, we should see that, just like Prabhupada said about women, he said, actually, all women belong to Krishna. Men think this woman or that woman, or some men think all women belong to me. Or at least they think this woman, my wife or my girlfriend, she belongs to me. And women think the same about men too. They think, my man. But actually all women and all men belong to Krishna. And that is the eternal fact. But that doesn't mean that we can't love one another. But we should love one another without this false sense of possessiveness. We should rather see that this person belongs to Krishna. And I belong to Krishna. And we are together Krishna's servants, so we should serve Krishna together. And yes, then that personal relationship becomes enlightened. And then Prabhupada actually said, then the original desire, you know, that desire for an eternal relationship, it actually becomes realized. I remember once Srila Prabhupada was talking about, because in Krishna consciousness, of course, devotees get married, as you can see. Here's Markandeya, here's his wife. So they're married, they have a relationship. But that relationship has Krishna at the center. So Srila Prabhupada, he once in a very beautiful, poetic way, he described a husband and wife in Krishna consciousness. He said, he compared them to two birds, you know, which serve together in this world, and then at the end of this life, together, they fly back to Godhead. Like, you know, you see at a certain season, the birds, they fly long distances. So together, the husband and wife, these two souls, they fly back home, back to Godhead. So that relationship can actually become eternal. Anything else? Yes?
How is it that impersonal philosophies like Buddhism and so have become so popular in the West?
Well, it is again what I was mentioning before, that people have become frustrated with the exoteric, with the world of matter. And so they want to get beyond that. And the philosophies of Buddhism and other impersonal philosophies, they teach a process of negation, negating this world, mentally negating. And so for, you know, Prabhupada says that initially this helps one, this actually helps one become determined in spiritual life. It is a kind of, you know, it's temporary, but at least initially, it is a kind of liberating experience. Oh, I can actually cancel this world out. I don't have to take it so seriously. Because it's really problematic for people when they're suffering so many anxieties and distress. And they're taking it all so, you know, real. There's no escape from it. And this is how in the Western world people have been trained. You know, the Western world, its religious background is Christianity. Now, Christianity has very good points, obviously. You know, there's a lot of bhakti in Christianity, but Christianity has a problem. It has a big, from our point of view, it has one big defect. And the one big defect is that in the Christian theology, the doctrine, since the time the Christian church was formed, the doctrine has been maintained that the soul, there's an admission of a soul, but the soul must have a material body in order to act. And this is a doctrine. And it's still there. Maybe Christians today aren't aware of it. You know, I think most Christians today have very little awareness of what Christianity is. Except maybe that you go to church whenever. People who do believe in Christianity, they often don't go to church very much. They just go for the ceremony and that's it. But the underlying doctrine there is that there is a soul, but the soul must have a material body. And so that's where you get this idea of the resurrection of the body. That on some fine day, the trumpets in heaven will blow, and all the graves will open, and the bodies will pop out, like in a zombie movie. I mean, and this is, you know, I'm not joking. This is the Christian theology. And every, we say, mainstream church upholds this doctrine. The Catholics, the Protestants, you know, Sweden is a Lutheran country, but all these, you know, maybe, I don't know, but you have that, what was his name, Emanuel Swedenborg? Maybe he's rejected that doctor. I don't know much about him, but he was some kind of mystic. But the Swedenborgian Church has only in the whole world 65,000 members, so that's the major churches. They accept this ideology that the body must be brought out of the ground and must be renewed. And therefore you find in the writings of the great theologians of the past, there was much debating about what to do, you know, how the body should be disposed of at the time of death. That's why they bury the bodies. And there was even fear, what will happen to a Christian if his body is burned up in a fire, or if his body is eaten by animals? Then the body is dissolved. And so there was a great fear that Christians who have died in that way, they won't be able to go to heaven because they've lost their body. Then other theologians said, no, but the atoms of the body will still be there somewhere, scattered, and God will miraculously bring all the atoms together on the day of judgment. And the body will just, you know, whoosh, suddenly form like out of a cloud. And then there was a question, yes, but some Christians, you know, they died when they were still little children, others when they're old people, so will everyone just go to heaven, you know, as a little baby, or as a 95-year-old lady, or, you know, or some died because their heads were chopped off, or, you know, arms and legs chopped, so will they come to heaven like cripples, amputees? And then the theologian said, no, everyone's body will be perfectly restored, and all the defects of the body, blemishes, whatever, will be corrected, and everyone will ascend to heaven in a body that's 30 years old. That is an official doctrine of the church. You may not know it, but it is an official doctrine of the church. It's still on the books that everyone who goes to heaven will go in a body that's 30 years old. You may not have known that, but I can provide you the actual Greek written by the theologians. This is written, you know, more than 1,000 years ago, and it still stands as Christian doctrine. So therefore, what I'm to bring us up to date in answer to your question, therefore you see the Christian attitude towards the body is that it is very real. It is a very real thing. The body is something you hang on to. So this is how Christians view the world. If the body is real, then the world is real, and all the problems of the world are very real. And therefore, this is a great recipe for a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety and suffering as a result of clinging to, you know, they actually think that there is a spiritual necessity to cling to the body as the self. They believe that the body is not the whole self, but it is part of the self. There's the soul, and there's the spirit, and there's the body. They have these, it's a threefold conception, soul, spirit, and body. And this is actually there in Judaism and in Islam also. These are all, it's actually the same religion. It's actually the same religion. They all trace their origin to a patriarch named Abraham. And Abraham in Sanskrit, Abraham, means not a Brahmana. Whoever this person was, he was Abraham. He was not a Brahmana. And that's why they have this, you know, this very firm bodily concept. Therefore, anyway, although, you know, I don't want to ridicule these religions, they have their good parts also, good sides. But this fact is there, that if you feel that the body is necessary, then you are forced to accept all the problems that embodied life bring. You know, and then their solution, of course, is that, well, when you're suffering from problems, you go to God and you pray. Please, God, help me with these problems. But this motivation, just like in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread, deliver us from evil. This type of motivation to pray for our material well-being, our bodily well-being, has been very much reduced in Christian civilization as a result of the rise of science and technology. Why pray for your daily bread when you can go to the supermarket and buy it? So people don't do that anymore. And people are relying more and more on science, technology, medicine, these things. They don't pray to God. So anyway, they're overwhelmed with anxieties. And they don't see a way out. And then comes along Buddhism and other forms of impersonalism, which say, this is all illusion. The impersonalists tell you that you're not the body. They equate personality with the body. So they're impersonalists, which means they say you're not the body. You're not a person. Now, Christianity is very much a personal religion, but unfortunately, as I say, they think person. So then, for people of of this background, that's very liberating. It's very wonderful to find out that, hey, I'm not the body, and I don't have to take all this seriously. And they find it, a very liberating exercise just to negate it. And the Buddhists and other impersonalist disciplines, they give a very well thought out process for negating physical and mental distress. But that also won't last, you see. Because as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, still we have to act. We agree, Bhagavad Gita says we're not the body. But while we're in this world, still we have to act. So just sitting and thinking, as it is stated, neti, neti, not this, not this, I'm not this, I'm not this, that's not real, that's not real, that's not real. That is not going to put food on the table. You still have to work, you still have to eat, you still have your social responsibility. Unless one goes to the cave, but who's going to do that, you see? So it's kind of like a big moving around in a big loop that brings you back to the same point. So in Krishna consciousness, the answer is, yes, we are not the body. We are soul. The soul is the person. And the body fits the person like a glove fits the hand. So the answer is not to negate the person or the body, but to engage the person and his body in Krishna's service. And by doing that, then we come to our actual spiritual identity as spiritual persons, as transcendental persons. We see the difference. You realize the difference between yourself and the body. And so the miseries of life, the anxieties, they pertain only to the body. The actual person is above that. And this can be realized by anyone. The example, Prabhupada gives a nice example of a coconut. I guess here in the West, when you buy a coconut in the shop, you get this brown nut with the hard shell, about this big. But actually, when they come from the tree, they're encased in a kind of big green, it looks like a big, huge green seed pod or something. Coconuts get about this big when they come from the tree. So you have to cut through this green covering, and then you get the nut inside. So when the coconut is ripe, then you can hear, you can rattle, you take the seed pod, this is how they know that it's ripe, they shake it, because the nut inside is loose, just a little loose, and it rattles around. Before it's ripe, it doesn't rattle, so you can hear it, rattle around, and then you know this one is ripe. So Srila Prabhupada said that when one becomes Krishna conscious, that green seed pod is like the body, and the nut is like the soul. And so you shake the body, and you can hear, in this sense, the soul is different. So the body, the green seed bud, can be chopped, whatever, but the nut inside is different from that. So similarly, when one understands, I'm not the body, he's still using the body. But if bad things happen to the body, he understands, I'm not that. That is different from me. Just like this seat is different from me. So the soul is seated in the body. So if this seat is damaged, I'm not damaged. You see? So this is the Krishna conscious answer. Yes? Okay. Any other questions? Yes?
In all these other religions, Christianity and Islam and so, they all talk about the devil like a person who is equally strong as God. But who is actually, I mean, is it a person or like how should one understand?
Yes, okay. So the first point about equally strong as God. Islam, well, Judaism, which is the oldest one, and then Christianity, and then Islam. As I said, they're coming out of one tradition. And there is a background to these three religions. There's a background religion. There's a religion out of which these three religions have appeared. And that background is Zoroastrianism, which is a very ancient religion of Persia. And there's a few... This religion now is very, very small. There's only a few thousand followers of... They're called the Parsis now. Around Bombay, they're mostly these Zoroastrians. They left Persia when it became Muslim and came to India. So, Zoroaster, he's known as Zoroaster. He's actually... mentioned in the Vedic scriptures, in the Puranas. His Sanskrit name is Jarashastra. And he taught the doctrine of dualism. So he was into demigod worship and fire sacrifice. And so these aspects are still there, in, even now, in the modern Parsi religion. So these are the Vedic elements, demigod worship and fire sacrifice. And he saw the universe as divided between the demigods, or the beings of light, and the beings of darkness, and each has their leader. So in Zoroastrianism, the leader of the beings of light is called Ormazd. So Ormazd, as far as I know, this is a form of the name Varuna. Anyway, this is, I don't want to get too much into this, but this all has its origins in very ancient Vedic tradition. And then Ormazd is opposed by Ahriman, who is equivalent to Satan. And there's an eternal struggle between the two. So this is dualism, religious dualism. And Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are influenced, very much influenced by this Zoroastrian dualism. So this is where they get this idea of God and equally powerful or almost equally powerful opponent, Satan. And this is not... You know, this is a concept limited to the material world. It's a materialistic concept, ultimately. It's cosmic, but it's still within the realm of the sphere of this universe. Because it is coming out of demigod worship, there is not really a conception of transcendence beyond. And then, so then your question is, who is this Satan? So, in the Bible... Satan appears in the Garden of Eden as a serpent who convinces Eve to then convince Adam that they should eat from the fruit of knowledge on this tree. So This story is very ancient. This story is before the Old Testament. This story you find in the Puranas, in the Bhavishya Purana, of a person named Adama, his wife Havyavati, and they are mleches, they are like tribal people, and they were seduced by the personality of Kali. It was called Kali Yuga, so the personality of Kali appeared to them in the form of a serpent. And he told them to take this fruit of knowledge. In the Persian language, the Persian word is halma. And this is, ancient Persian language is similar to Sanskrit, so the Sanskrit equivalent is soma. So soma is a kind of nectar which is produced from sacrifice, which is only supposed to be taken by brahmanas. So the personality of Kali convinced Adam and Eve to take this soma, this fruit of, or this juice, this rasa from sacrifice. So they were not qualified because they're low-class people. They were not qualified to take this. And that was considered a sinful act. So this is the origin of that old story. So anyway, Satan, if he's taken to be the personality of Kali, as on the evidence of the Bhavishya Purana, then he is a real person. He's a demigod in charge of sin. The demigods are each in charge of some particular aspect of the cosmic drama. So Kali is in charge of sin. That's his department. So his business is to promote sin among human beings, to make it appear to be very nice, to engage in sinful activities. He's very clever at that. So that's what he does. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.